and tonight's address in particular is entitled Samuel Standing as Appointed Over Them. Brother Roger.
Brother Chairman,
my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, we're almost at the end of the story, aren't we? Because we're really running out of narrative concerning the life of Samuel. In fact, in the 1st of Samuel chapter 19, we've really come to the last major episode that the scriptures present to us concerning the life of the old prophet before he was ultimately to pass from the scene. And so it's interesting that we note in that regard that the story that we've read together this evening in the 1st of Samuel chapter 19 again brings together the old prophet and the new king in the form of David the fugitive. It's interesting that we're therefore, as it were, given an insight into this last and what we believe was a very important meeting between Samuel the seer and David before they were parted yet again and David went his way, because of the fugitive existence he would now live for a number of years under the hands of the pursuing Saul. And we do hope that, although we're only going to cover just a few brief verses, that there's a number of very interesting and powerful exhortational points that we will be able to extract from the narrative this evening. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 19, therefore, in verse 18, we're told that David fled and escaped and came to Samuel, to Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him. In fact, the word escaped is used on four separate occasions in this record. You'll notice at the end of the 10th verse, David fled and escaped that night. The end of verse 12, he went and fled and escaped. Verse 17, why hast thou deceived me so and sent away mine enemy that he has escaped? Verse 18, so David fled and escaped and came to Samuel to Ramah. And so what we have introduced here is the story of this very difficult night of crisis in the life of the young man as he endeavoured to slip away from the clutches of Saul. And obviously we're given the indication here that the brooding spirit of melancholia that was coming upon the king was now reaching that point of obsession. He'd already three times thrust a javelin at David. And David realized that the time had come when it was very important that he escape out of the hands of the king. Now, when it says in verse 18 that he fled, the word literally means to bolt. He took his opportunity and he struck out as it was for freedom. And the word escaped here is the word in the Hebrew, malat, which means to escape by slipperiness. It's almost as if we have the idea of the clutching hands of Saul and David slithering out just in the nick of time to escape by slipperiness, as if he just got away from the clutches of the grasping king. It's the same word, interestingly enough, used in Daniel chapter 11, but these, the children of Ammon, the chief of the children of Ammon, Edom and Moab, shall escape out of the hand of the king of the north. Well, here's David on this occasion just eluding the clutches of Saul as he endeavours to get away. One can imagine, if you were David, that you'd want to put as much distance as you could between a mad and vengeful king and yourself. In fact, we remember the story in the life of David himself later on of a man who cursed the king and who realised the danger into which he'd been placed and who fled north to get away from the wrath of David himself. We're told that Joab pursued him. Remember that story? Well, they finally caught up with that man at Abel Beth Maacah, right at the north of the land, because that man feared the wrath of King David himself. It was a natural enough thing to do. He put as many miles as he could between Jerusalem and himself. Well, one can imagine that same spirit coming to David here as he desired to escape from Saul. And therefore, it's rather interesting that we notice in verse 18 that the record says that he escaped from Saul and came to Samuel to Ramah.
And the reason why that's interesting is because if we look at the geography of the land, what we find is that David, in endeavouring to flee from Saul on this occasion, came all the way from Gibeah to Ramah. Why? A whole 2 miles.
That was some escape indeed, wasn't it?
Isn't that interesting? He only travelled 2 miles to the north to Samuel. And yet somehow he felt that in moving to Samuel, that he instinctively felt that there was a measure of safety in Ramah with the aged prophet. I suppose there's a lesson in that, isn't there? That you see, David saw a spiritual dimension to danger and to safety as well as a literal and a physical one. And he saw that safety doesn't just lie in physical distance. His safety lies in the principles of association with those that we can trust in life. And therefore, he only in fact travelled just 2 miles north from Gibeah, which was the household of the king, and travelled to, as the record tells us in the 18th verse here, to Samuel, who resided in Ramah, which incidentally we believe, having placed Ramah there, we believe is what is known in modern day times as Nebi Samuel, the prophet Samuel. That's the modern place name as it's currently called in the Arabic. So, you see, the other thing that's interesting about that verse is that it says that he came to Samuel and told him all that Saul had done to him. So you see, he didn't just come to Samuel, he came to Samuel in order that he might confide in him. Can you feel that sense of that verse? He told him all that Saul had done unto him. Into the open ear of Samuel, David felt a measure of confidence in pouring out all of his woes and all of his worries and all of the problems that had beset this young man in life. So you see, he obviously felt that Samuel was someone that he could trust in. There's a lesson in that, isn't there? Have you got someone like that in the truth? Someone that you feel that you can go to and genuinely confide your woes to in the knowledge that they are secure in the ears of that person. You know, I suppose what makes that all the more remarkable is that when you look at the divine narrative, we're presented with this idea that there was quite a significant age difference between David and Jonathan, wasn't there? Something in the order of perhaps 10 or 20 years between David and Jonathan. And if there was that age gap between David and Jonathan, then there must have been an even bigger gap between David and Saul. But if there was a gap between David and Saul that was large, then imagine how large the age difference must be between David and Samuel, who was already an old man at the time he crowned Saul as a young man. There must have been a tremendous age difference between the old seer in Ramah and the young man David. But despite that difference of age, brothers and sisters, they locked together like that spiritually. And that young man, as he fled from the clutches of Saul, instinctively turned to Samuel as the place where he ought to go to safety. A lovely spirit there, isn't there? And that's how it should be in the truth. It ought to be in the truth that sometimes there is a young person and an old person that can see eye to eye in spiritual things. And there's no age barrier in that respect in the truth. Of course there's a difference. A young person hasn't got the experience of life than an older one has. We understand that. But that ought to be no barrier to spiritual kinship. And it's a lovely thing to see the way in which David fled to the old man on this occasion. Now the record tells us in the 18th verse that having poured out all of his woes and all of his concerns to Samuel, that Samuel decided to do something. It says that he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naoth. And obviously we believe that that was a decision that Samuel had made on both their behalf. They went and dwelt in Naoth. Now as to where Naoth was, if we turn over the page, we find in the 19th verse, was told Saul saying, "Behold, David is at Naoth, in Ramah." So whatever Naoth was, it was actually in Ramah. It was part of Ramah. And we believe that the reason for Samuel's decision on this occasion to take David to Naoth was twofold. Perhaps it offered a measure of greater protection. We're not told. But we believe that the greatest reason why Samuel made this decision to take David to dwell at Naoth was because he wanted to strengthen David for the challenges that lay ahead of him in the years to come. Samuel could see that there was many a burden yet to be laid upon the shoulders of the young man before he would assume the kingship. And we believe that Samuel saw this as an opportunity to strengthen David spiritually for those problems that David would yet endure. Now this word Naoth, Strong's tells us that the word means literally a residence or dwelling. The word means, according to Strong's, residence or dwellings. The Jewish Targum translates the word the house of learning. The house of learning. That's the Jewish Targum. In the Arabic, there's a very similar word, the word noya. N-A-W-Y-A-T-H, rendered phonetically in the English, noya, and it means in the Arabic, the place of study. So there's an idea developing, isn't there? As Strong says, it means residence or dwellings. The Targum says it means the house of learning. The cognate or similar word in the Arabic is the place of study. Edersheim says in his Old Testament Bible History, page 103, he says, it seems to have been a block of dwellings within a compound occupied by an order of prophets. That's Edersheim's definition of the word Naoth. I'll say that again. It seems to have been a block of dwellings within a compound occupied by an order of prophets. And Delitzsch says in his commentary upon this section, he says that the word Naoth is a proper name applied to the common dwelling of the pupils of the prophets who had gathered around Samuel in the neighbourhood of Ramah. It is a proper name applied to the common dwelling of the pupils of the prophets who had gathered around Samuel in the neighbourhood of Ramah. So Naoth was a suburb of Ramah, but it wasn't any suburb. It was specifically the suburb in which the school of the prophets that Samuel had founded in Ramah was to be found. It was the block of dwellings where the prophets lived. And within that block of dwellings, they engaged in their various activities as the school or the college of the prophets in that place. Now let's see if we can just find a little more in the narrative then about the schools of the prophets. Because there's something very interesting about this in terms of our consideration of the life of Samuel. Now, here's some information on the schools of the prophets, as such as we are able to glean from the scriptures. A lot of things, really. First of all, we're given to understand that the schools of the prophets had an established organizational structure of authority. There were lines of communication and lines of authority within these schools, according to the 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 32. We're told that the schools were communally based. They shared their food together and they had shared or communal accommodation, according to the 2 Kings chapter 6 verses 1 to 4. We're told in another place, in both the 1 Samuel chapter 10 verse 5 and the 2 Kings chapter 3 verse 15, that worship and the use of music and song formed a very important part of the spiritual activities in these schools of the prophets. We're told in the 2 Kings chapter 4 and verse 23 that there were regular meetings in these schools, that they were scheduled on both a weekly and a monthly basis. We're told elsewhere that there was the matter of diligent application to the study of the word, to the writing of scriptural matter, and also to the copying of scriptural texts. So the schools of the prophets were engaged in the preservation of the scriptures as such as we have them today. And if we're to trace the influence of the schools of the prophets down through time, then we find that in the 1 Kings chapter 18 verse 4, there is an indication that the schools of the prophets were there in existence in the days of Ahab. That in the days of Uzziah the king, Amos makes an incidental allusion to the schools of the prophets. In the 1 Kings 18 verse 4, of course, that's a reference to Obadiah hiding the prophets of Yahweh by 50s in a cave. The prophets of Yahweh. There was an established group there in the days of Ahab. The allusion in the days of Uzziah in Amos chapter 7 verse 14 is that when he's rebuked, Amos says, I was not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet, and makes use of the very terms that that were used of the schools of the prophets. In the days of Josiah, we read of Huldah the prophetess in the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 34 and verse 22. And it says of Huldah the prophetess that she dwelt at the college. And in the days of Nehemiah, at the time of the revival and the return, we're told in Nehemiah chapter 6 and verse 7 that he endeavoured again to bring together a grouping of prophets in Jerusalem after the order of the schools of the prophets of old. Now the interesting thing about all that is that all of that work was started by Samuel. And Naoth, in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 19, verse 18, is the first indication of one of those schools that we have in the narrative. In fact, there were a number of schools. There were schools at Ramah, as indicated here in the record of the 1st of Samuel 19. But later on, we read that there was another school at Gilgal, yet another at Bethel, that there was one at Jericho, and quite possibly, we believe there was one at Carmel as well. And those are only the ones that we have some definite indication on. There are other clues in the divine narrative that there may, in fact, have been other schools in other places. Now, this was a very great and a very important work that was performed by Samuel the prophet. And out of our study this evening, God willing, we hope to dwell on that a little further in the next few verses as to just how significant and just how important that work was, a work that was undoubtedly begun by Samuel himself in his beloved hometown of Ramah. So when we're told here in the 1st of Samuel chapter 19 and verse 18 that he took David to dwell at Naoth, what he did, we believe, was that the two of them went into the compound of the school of the prophets in that place in order that David might be spiritually encouraged for those problems that were yet to come upon him. In verse 19 it says, "And it was told Saul, saying, Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah." You think, well, there's not much we can say about that verse. Well, probably isn't, but it's pretty interesting, that phrase. It was told Saul, saying. It was told Saul. Can we have a look at these passages? In the 1st of Samuel, chapter 22 and verse 9. First of Samuel, chapter 22 and verse 9. "Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob." In chapter 23 and verse 7. "And it was told Saul that David was come to Keilah." Chapter 24 verse 1. "And it came to pass, when Saul was returned from following the Philistines, that it was told him, saying, Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Chapter 26, verse 1. "And the Ziphites came into Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon?" And again in chapter 27, and verse 4. "And it was told Saul that David was fled to Gath." So you see, that statement in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 19, and verse 19, is the first of a series of incidents in which gossiping tongues told Saul of the whereabouts of David. It happens in ecclesial life, doesn't it? It was told Saul. As someone rightly said concerning the ecclesial grapevine, it badly needs pruning. And it's true, isn't it? There's too many times in Life and the Truth where too many people are busy telling other people about things that was no business of theirs to tell. And one of the tragedies of that simple series of passages, it was told Saul concerning all the movements of David, was that later on those very people would support David as king. But they didn't hesitate to betray him earlier on. You know, there's an hesitation in that, isn't there? There's a bit of a tendency, I suppose, for all of us to let our tongues run away with us at times. And what you've got to stop and say is, whatever you are saying, and whoever you're saying it to, is it really going to be good for the truth? You know, there's a golden rule there in life, isn't it?
Whatever we do and whatever we say, is it going to be in the best interest of the truth? And if you can't honestly say yes to that, then don't say it. If only we could apply that rule in life, there'd be many things that we would hold back from saying. And you know, I suppose the other exhortation that comes out of verse 19 is this, that for all of the gossiping tongues that betrayed David, it was told Saul, saying, behold, David is at Naoth. There's one thing that we can be sure of, and that's this, that the whispering would never, ever have come from the lips of Samuel. He wasn't like that, was he? And that's something that David, no doubt himself, was absolutely sure of. David's flight to Samuel was on the basis that he absolutely trusted that man that he could keep counsel. And so here's Samuel, an old man, a man who's eloquent in instruction, a man who's impassioned in prayer, but he knows the virtue of when to keep silence. Do you know that? Do I know that? It's one of the greatest virtues in life, isn't it? Knowing to keep counsel. Knowing how to guard the doors of our mouth. You know, Proverbs chapter 11, verse 13 says, a talebearer revealeth secrets, but he that is of a faithful spirit concealeth the matter. A talebearer revealeth secrets. Oh, I really shouldn't tell you, but have you promised not to tell anybody else? A faithful spirit concealeth the matter. Samuel was like that. And David knew that. That's why he'd fled to him. Now look, here's the lesson then out of the life of Samuel in those first two verses. Here he is. He truly was, in so many wonderful ways to David on this occasion, the succourer of the young man. He's all of the things that we would like to be to our brothers and sisters. Because you see, notwithstanding the close proximity to Gibeah, David, in fleeing to Samuel, felt that he would indeed be safe. He felt that he could confide in Samuel as being a faithful friend and confidant, one that he could pour all his woes and cares out to in the knowledge that counsel would be guarded. You know, sometimes there are people in the truth that may have the wisdom to give you advice, but you just wouldn't trust them. Nevertheless. Because however good their advice may be, they haven't learned how to keep counsel. And you somehow know that your problem will end up in the ears of other people. Samuel wasn't like that. And not only was he a faithful friend to David, but he was able to be a spiritual guide and mentor to the young captain. This lovely story of a young man and an old man that have been drawn together in the truth at this moment of crisis in David's life ought to be like that in the truth for us today. I suppose that's a responsibility for both young and old. How much time do young brethren and young sisters in the truth spend with older people? It's a very hard thing for younger people. How much time do you spend with older brethren? Just saying hello, just talking to them, giving them 5 minutes. Lots of older people in the truth are very lonely. And yet for all of that, they can be wonderful friends. And sometimes you can go up to an older person and find to your absolute surprise that they know all about the truth too, and are quite enthusiastic in their own way. And you could have had a bond there if you'd only tried. Well, David didn't miss his opportunity with regard to working and talking to Samuel. And we also realise that Samuel, in the wisdom that he had taken David on this occasion to dwell at Naoth in order that he might strengthen the young man for those problems that lay ahead. He realised that the spirit of praise and worship that would take place in the school would have been a wonderful boost to David's spirit, and in that regard he became David's sympathetic teacher and his succourer in life. And not only that, but you see at the bottom here, rather interesting, that there are signs in the divine narrative later on that these two men didn't just waste time. In fact, we might come and have a look at that reference. In the first of Chronicles chapter 9, which of course is later on in the days of David himself, we have this rather interesting statement in the 22nd verse. It says, all those which were chosen to be porters in the gates were 212. These were reckoned by their genealogy in their villages, whom David and Samuel the seer did ordain in their set office. Where did David and Samuel ever find the time
to organise the matter of the doorkeepers for the temple. Where did they find the time to talk about that? And maybe that it was at this particular time, this brief interlude in the life of David, when the old man had come together with the young man, that I can just imagine Samuel taking David to Naoth and saying, "Now look, we've got a brief moment here, and I want you to get out your paper and pencil, because there's a few things we're going to talk about with regard to the running of the kingdom when I'm gone and you're king. Now get your pencil out. Now this is what we have to do, young man." And they started to talk about the principles of organizing the temple worship that it might run smoothly and efficiently and spiritually under David's reign. And that there was collaboration there between Samuel and David. When else in the record is there an indication of opportunity for those two to collaborate in this way? So there are signs, you see, that therefore Samuel had become a very practical advisor and organizer on behalf of David to stimulate him in those affairs of kingship that lay ahead of him. So there's a good spirit there in the life of Samuel, isn't there? Isn't that what we'd expect of the old man? He didn't waste opportunities, did he? He took David and he said, "Look, there's some things we can talk about. Let's get on with the job." And so he did. Now you notice in the 1st of Samuel chapter 19 and verse 20 that it says there that Saul sent messengers to take David. Now that's an interesting statement, really. Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as appointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. Now you see, if you go through the story of David's wanderings from this chapter on, chapter after chapter after chapter in the 1st of Samuel, you'll find David fleeing around Israel and Saul pursuing him with his men. And around they go, buzzing around the mountains of Judea. Saul in pursuit, David ever trying to escape. But surprisingly on this occasion, we're told in the 20th verse that Saul didn't come himself, he sent messengers. I wonder why he sent messengers. It's almost as if Saul showed a marked reticence to personally come and apprehend David. I wonder why that was. In fact, the word messengers is the Hebrew word malak, and it means literally to dispatch as a deputy. Now, what's a deputy? Well, a deputy is sort of someone that you get to do your job for you. He deputized somebody else to do the job. He sent deputies on his behalf. Do you know why he did that? Because of verse 19. It was told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah." That's Samuel territory. "No, I'm not going there," says Saul. And he sent someone else to do the job because David had fled to the one place that Saul himself really didn't want to go anywhere near. Saul still stood in awe of the old prophet, didn't he? Absolutely in awe of the old prophet. There was no way that Saul would go anywhere near Naoth in Ramah. He sent deputies on his behalf. You know, the same principle is at work in the days of Ahab. Ahab showed that same awe for Elijah the prophet, didn't he? In the days of the New Testament, Herod held John in the same awe. There was something very grand and majestic about those men. Elijah, John, Samuel. And on every occasion, there's the counterpart of a weak and vacillating king who really underneath looked up with tremendous respect to that spiritual strength in that person. No, Saul wasn't going to go anywhere near Ramah. He sent messengers. You know, there's a lesson that comes out of that, and that's this. You see, isn't it interesting? Here's two men, Saul and David. And when David's faced with that crisis in his life, what does he do? He turned instinctively to Samuel. And when Saul is presented with the crisis, he instinctively keeps away from Samuel. So, of course, the exhortation is, who are you drawn to in the truth? Who are you drawn to in the truth? It's very important, isn't it? David instinctively turned to Samuel because there was a spiritual bond. They were able to talk about divine principles together. And Saul, for the very same reason, didn't want to have anything to do with Samuel, rather.
because there was an emptiness in spiritual things as far as Saul was concerned. There was no basis of discussion, no communal sharing of interests between Saul and Samuel, like there was with David. Sometimes it happens in the truth, unfortunately, that like attracts like. And that sometimes we're attracted to people who maybe are not the best friends for us to be drawn to at all, because they're not really improving us spiritually. So stop and take care with regard to companionship in the truth. Are the ones that you're drawn to in ecclesial life those that are going to spiritually help you? Think about your friends and say, well, do we really help each other to grow in the things of the truth, or do we really spend our time doing all sorts of other things that are all very amusing and interesting, but out of it all we probably don't really grow much spiritually? I wonder if I'm being drawn to the right people. There's room for thinking about that, isn't there? Verse 20 says that having sent the messengers, that they saw, the messengers that is, they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as appointed over them. Now, if you come back to the 10th chapter for a moment, we actually have this word, the company of the prophets, used on two separate occasions, but interestingly enough, the word is different on the two occasions. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 10 and verse 5, we have the word, the company of the prophets, used on an early occasion, but it's a different word in the Hebrew to that of chapter 19. Here in the 1st of Samuel chapter 10 it says, and after that thou shalt come to the hill of God, where is the garrison of the Philistines, and it shall come to pass, when thou art come thither to the city, that thou shalt meet a company of prophets. And the word company in the 1st of Samuel chapter 10 here is the Hebrew word hebel, C-H-E-B-E-L. And it literally means a rope as twisted together. And the indication is of a company of people that were closely bound together spiritually. Hebel, a rope as twisted together. There's the company of the prophets. A tightly bound community, bound together by the spirit of the things that move them all. That's not the word found in chapter 19. Back in chapter 19, it says, when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying. And this time, the word in the Hebrew is the word lahaka. L-A-H-A-K-A-H. L-A-H-A-K-A-H. Lahaka. And the word is considered to be an inverted form, a letter inverted form of the Hebrew kahala, which is the Old Testament word, effectively, for ecclesia. It's a letter inverted form of the Hebrew word kahala, that is the ecclesia. So here we have an ecclesia of prophets. They're bound together, no doubt, as in the 1st of Samuel chapter 10, but here the emphasis on the fact that they are a body, as it were, of people brought together. They are the ecclesia of the prophets. And what are they doing? Well, they're busy prophesying, says the record. And the word prophesying means to speak or to sing by inspiration. So the whole ecclesia in this place were busy speaking and singing by inspiration. In the 2nd of Kings chapter 3, we have a reference to how that apparently worked. In the 2nd of Kings chapter 3 and verse 15, here evidently is the spirit of this mood of prophecy that was at work in the ecclesia of the prophets. 2nd of Kings chapter 3 and verse 15, which says, reading from verse 14 for connection, Elisha said, as Yahweh of armies liveth before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee, but now bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass, when the minstrel played, that the hand of Yahweh came upon him. So here was a combination of music on the one side and the spirit of prophecy on the other, working in harmony. And obviously the music had that special effect in that way. The impact of the spiritual music, in turn, was reflected in the prophecy that followed. And evidently that's the spirit of what's happening back here in the 1st of Samuel chapter 19, verse 20. So there was no doubt both prophecy and music and praise both happening at the same time. And I suppose there's a lesson in that too, isn't there? Our music, in the truth, is designed to help us spiritually. And so that means that when we're singing a hymn, we shouldn't be looking around like this to see Sister So-and-so's hat and notice Brother So-and-so's not there today. Our music is is designed to lift us spiritually as part of our activities in the truth. It's a very, very important aspect of our work and worship in the truth. Obviously, it was important in these days here. It was something that Samuel considered important. And he brought together those other matters of study and prophecy together with spiritual music. And there's a good lesson in that too, because music will be an integral part of the kingdom age, won't it? And the lesson as far as young people are concerned in that regard is that if you're listening to the music of the world today, then you just won't be prepared for the music of the kingdom age. And you won't have the right tastes to enjoy the music of the kingdom age. And if you haven't therefore lifted your mind to contemplate that music that ennobles and lifts the character, well, then you're heading down the wrong direction as far as music is concerned. So be careful. It's very easy to develop tastes that will not in fact increase your appreciation of things divine. Well, obviously, whatever the music was on this occasion, no doubt it was good music. It was wholesome music. It was music that helped the spirit of the ecclesia of the prophets here as they stood busily prophesying. It's an interesting statement that occurs in Stanley's History of the Jewish Church, Volume 1, page 354. And he describes the school of the prophets in this way. He says, "Thither in that age of change and dissolution, Samuel gathered round him all that was generous and devout in the people of God. David the shepherd warrior and wandering outlaw, Saul the wild and wayward king, Heman the grandson of Samuel himself, chief singer afterwards in David's court, and known especially as the king's seer. Gad, the devoted companion of David in his exile. Nathan, his stern reprover in after times, and the wise counsellor of David's wise son. All, however different their characters and stations, seem to have found a home within those sacred haunts. All caught the same divine inspiration. All were, for the time at least, drawn together by that invigorating and elevating atmosphere." And what a stirring and encouraging and elevating moment that must have been in the first of Samuel. He says, "Thither in that age of change and dissolution, Samuel gathered round him all that was generous and devout in the people of God. David the shepherd warrior and wandering outlaw, Saul the wild and wayward king, Heman the grandson of Samuel himself, chief singer afterwards in David's court, and known especially as the king's seer. Gad, the devoted companion of David in his exile. Nathan, his stern reprover in after times, and the wise counsellor of David's wise son. All, however different their characters and stations, seem to have found a home within those sacred haunts. All caught the same divine inspiration. All were, for the time at least, drawn together by that invigorating and elevating atmosphere." And what a stirring and encouraging and elevating moment that must have been in the first of Samuel chapter 19 and verse 20, when the delegated messengers of Saul burst upon that particular scene. We're told in the verse there that not only was the company of the prophets prophesying, but that Samuel was standing as appointed over them. Young's literal translates that phrase, Samuel standing set over them. Samuel standing as set over them. The Jerusalem Bible translates the phrase, Samuel as their leader. Rotherham says, Samuel standing as head over them. And the indication of the phrase is that therefore Samuel was in fact presiding over the whole assembly. Now can you just picture that scene? Here's the whole company of the prophets prophesying. There's music, there is prophecy, there is activity, and there down at the front of the hall is the old man himself, perhaps with his hands outstretched in prayer to the Father, and Samuel is standing as the president of the whole assembly of the prophets, as we would expect them to be, and as Elisha later was in the occasion of his own work amidst the schools. And so, as head of the prophets, we can anticipate that Samuel was the one who was the driving force and the guiding spirit of all of those people assembled on that occasion. I can just imagine the messengers bursting in through the back door, and they're going to come to take David. And they come up to Ramah, and up into the high place, and up into Naoth, and into the dwelling of the prophets. And they burst open the door of the main sanctuary.
And there the startling scene meets their eyes of all this swelling chorus of people singing praises to God, and they're all dressed in the rough garb of the prophets, and David's somewhere in the midst of them, but they certainly can't pick out who he is. And there's Samuel as the president of the whole assembly down at the front, and they were absolutely moved by the spirit of those things. You know, David goes down, brothers and sisters, in history as a prophet for that reason. You come and have a look at these rather interesting references. In the 2nd of Kings chapter 23, Samuel, the presiding influence of that whole assembly. Well, just look at the way that the divine narrative takes up this man's work in later times. In the 2nd of Kings 23 and verse 21, the record tells us, "And the king commanded all the people, saying, keep the Passover unto Yahweh your God, as it is written in the book of the covenant. Surely there was not holden such a Passover from the days of the judges that judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel." I want you to notice those two points of comparison. There was no Passover held, it says, since the days of the judges that judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel. Can you see those two points? Now come and look at the parallel reference in the 2nd of Chronicles 35. Josiah's great Passover. Well, says the narrative in Kings, was such a wonderful Passover. There was nothing to compare with it in the days of the judges, and nothing to compare with it in the days of the kings. 2nd of Chronicles 35 verse 17. "And the children of Israel that were present kept the Passover at that time, and the feast of unleavened bread 7 days. And there was no Passover like to that kept in Israel from the days of Samuel the prophet, neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover." So you see that in the book of Kings, the two points of comparison are noted as the days of the judges and as the days of the kings of Israel. But when Chronicles gives us the parallel statement, although it refers to the days of the judges and to Samuel, who was in fact the last judge, it doesn't call him a judge. He's described as Samuel the prophet. And he goes down in history as a prophet despite his work of judging, because we believe of the greatness of that work he did in implementing the schools of the prophets. Now let's come and have a look at that in the New Testament. In the book of Hebrews chapter 11, you see how the New Testament takes up that statement. Samuel standing as presiding over them, the head of the schools of the prophets in Israel. In Hebrews chapter 11, we read these words in verse 32. "And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell," and he goes into the time of the judges, "the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets." So here's a man who really was, in a sense, the last of the judges of Israel, and yet in the divine narrative, as Paul expounds his role, in Hebrews 11 verse 32, it's Samuel and of the prophets. See the way that he's placed? Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13, verse 19. "And when he had destroyed 7 nations in the land of Canaan, he divided their land to them by lot, and after that he gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet." See that? Now Samuel was a judge, absolutely and clearly in the divine narrative. But when he's taken up in times after his own, he is considered in the divine narrative to be the prophet of Israel and not the judge. Acts chapter 3, one last reference. Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3 and verse 23. And it shall come to pass that every soul which will not hear that prophet shall be destroyed from among the people. Yea, and all the prophets from Samuel and those that follow after. So not only is he counted as Samuel the prophet, but he is counted as the beginning of the prophets. You see that? All the prophets from Samuel and as many that follow after. Now you stop and think about that for a minute. And of course that's not technically correct, is it? Let's just run through what we have then here by way of summary. Samuel the prophet, the matter of this one who presided over the prophets in his own day, but who also established that spirit of things in Israel. You see, he was confirmed to be a prophet from his childhood years. We're told that as a young man, in fact as a young child in the temple, all Israel knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet. And just as he was a prophet in his childhood years, so in his old age, as Saul comes to him, he's known in the divine narrative as Samuel the seer. So despite his labours as a judge, he was recorded in later history as being preeminently both seer and prophet. He was not the first with the prophetic gift. Abraham and Sarah were prophets. There were prophets in the days of the judges. There were prophets here in Numbers chapter 11 in the days of Moses. But he's regarded as the founder of the prophetic office, not of the prophetic gift. There were prophets before Samuel, but Samuel's the one who organizes the prophetic office to the extent that it became a driving force in the land of Israel, and for that reason, he's regarded as the head and the founder of the prophets. And so as we've just seen, Samuel is taken up in the New Testament record, not so much as the last judge, but as the first in the era of the prophets. That's clearly the way that Scripture expounds that man. There's a marvellous lesson that comes out. Let's go back to the 1st of Samuel, chapter 19. Now you see, what we're saying out of all that is this. That is a tremendous spirit of lesson that comes out of that 22nd verse. Samuel standing as appointed over the prophets. You see, what we've considered in our studies is an old man who's about to relinquish the reins of government. In chapter 9, he anoints Saul. In chapter 12, he presents his resignation speech. In chapter 15, he rejects Saul. In chapter 16, he anoints David. And therefore, we tend to talk about Samuel, don't we? Well, we say Samuel was that man that bridged the era of the judges and ushered in the time of the monarchy in Israel. Well, so he did. But he did more than that. Samuel didn't just bring in the monarchy. Samuel ushered in the era of the prophets. And that's how the divine record presents it. Not so much as the bringing in of the monarchy, but the man that ushered in the era of the prophets in Israel. That ever their voice might be heard as the stirrings of the conscience of the nation. Samuel was the inspiring founding father of that principle at work in the nation. And it's almost as if Samuel said this, right, the time of the judges is over. Now that the kings are going to reign, side by side with that civil authority, there will be a spiritual voice in the land, and I'm going to begin that principle. And as an old man, we believe, he gave his heart and his mind to those things. This was the labour of his old age, the schools of the prophets. The labours of an old man, the last thing that Samuel ever did. We believe that his declining years were marked with the building up of those schools. His own sons had failed him. But he had many spiritual sons that he'd drawn around him that did respond to Samuel. And by the time he died, those young men were powerful voices for truth in the land themselves. Gad, Nathan, David himself, Iddo the prophet later on. And those schools of the prophets survived for generation after generation after generation because this man in his old age gave time and attention to that. Now there's a terrific lesson that comes out of that, and that's this. You know the best thing, the finest thing that any one of us can do in ecclesial life is to stimulate the generation that follows. When you think about it, that's all we really can do, isn't it? You look at Joshua and you look at Hezekiah and you look at Josiah and all those men that had marvellous reforms because of the strength of their own personality, and when they died,
their reforms died with them. Not so Samuel. He built a spirit into the generation to come. That was his legacy to Israel. That's a marvellous thing. And our responsibility in ecclesial life, if ever there was one that we ought to take up as a lesson from the life of Samuel, it's just that. That our golden desire ought to be to stimulate the generation after us so that when we die, they will carry on the flame of the truth. That's the finest thing any one of us can do. You doing that? That's what we should be doing. And all of our Sunday schools and Bible classes and special efforts and fraternals are so that one generation can stimulate another to continue the work begun. You know, I really think that that's probably the greatest thing that Samuel ever accomplished. For all the greatness of his own labours, when his life was ended, brothers and sisters, within the space of a few years, there'd be most in Israel who would not know anything about that man. But he lived on in those schools and in those prophets that were the guiding conscience of that nation for many a year afterwards, all inspired by his word. It's a good lesson in that, isn't it? A very good lesson. And so it says in verse 20 that Samuel, standing as appointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. They couldn't help it. They were so overwhelmed by the grandeur of that scene and by the spirit and mood of the occasion. Verse 21 goes on to say, and when it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they prophesied also. Now, Rotherham translates that phrase from the last part of verse 20 as follows. Rotherham says, then came the Spirit of God upon the messengers of Saul, and they also were moved to prophesy. And when they told Saul, and he sent other messengers, then were they also moved to prophesy. And when Saul again sent messengers a third time, then were they also moved to prophesy. And we have this remarkable story of these three lots of messengers coming up, and again and again and again being moved by the majesty and the spirit of what was transpiring in that school of the prophets. You know, that sort of reminds us of something, doesn't it, in the New Testament. John chapter 7. It sort of reminds us of this remarkable episode in the life of the Lord himself. Remember when Jesus went up to the feast to speak? We're told in the 10th verse of John chapter 7 that when his brethren were gone up, then went he also up unto the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. But having gone up in secret, the 28th verse tells us that Jesus cried in the temple as he taught. And he said, ye both know me, and ye know whence I am, and I am not come of myself. But he that sent me is true, whom ye know not, but I know him, for I am from him, and he hath sent me. Then they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him, because his hour was not yet come. Verse 32. The Pharisees heard that the people murmured such things concerning him, and the Pharisees and the chief priests, alias Saul, sent officers to take him. And Jesus said unto them, yet a little while I am with you, and then I go unto him that sent me. Ye shall seek me, and shall not find me, and where I am, thither ye cannot come. You know, I can just see that. I can just see that episode. The chief priests and the Pharisees, who are governed by the same spirit as Saul, send their deputies, as did Saul, to take Jesus. And Jesus stands up in the temple in verse 34, and in come the officers to take him, and the Lord's standing there, and he says, ye shall seek me, and shall not find me, and where I am, you can't come. And there was some spirit so gripped those men that they found themselves unable to take him. Verse 44. Some of them would have taken him, but no man laid hands on him. Then came the officers to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said unto them, why have ye not brought him? And the officers said, you haven't been to Naoth. You don't know what's going on up there. You've got no idea of the spirit of those things. Never man spake like this man. Very similar story, isn't it? And the spirit of the truth in the preaching of Christ was similarly powerful in his day to convince even those who had been sent to take him. The Pharisees, of course, were governed with rage. And as we come back to the first of Samuel, we find that that same spirit of anger and rage finally gripped Saul himself,
as he endeavoured to come and take David. In fact, we're told in the 22nd verse, "Then went he also to Ramah and came to a great well that is in situ." But the Septuagint translates the phrase, "And Saul was very angry, he went himself." Moffat's, which obviously is drawing on the Septuagint, said, "Then Saul grew furious, he went himself." And there was that spirit of madness, of real anger, that finally gripped Saul, because on three successive occasions his messengers had been utterly powerless to take David from the schools of the prophets. Now stop and think about it. If Saul was angry, as undoubtedly he was in verse 22, what do you think his anger was about? What was Saul furious about? Was it the ineffectiveness of his messengers? No. Was he angry because of the delay in apprehending David? No. Do you know what he was angry about? I think the record tells us this. He was angry with an impotent, unreasoning rage against the power of Samuel in that place. I believe that's what he was upset about. He had a rage against the power of Samuel in that place. Now, I wanted you to see why that's so as we read verse 22 carefully. It says that he came to a great well that is in situ, and he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" And one said, "Behold, they be at Naoth in Ramah." Now, you see, it seems strange for Saul to ask the question, "Where are they?" because he'd already been told in verse 19 that David is at Naoth in Ramah. Why would he come and say, "Where are they?" and the message comes back, "Behold, they're at Naoth in Ramah"? Well, I believe the reason is this, that you see, his question wasn't so much to establish where they were as to confirm that they were still there. It wasn't so much that he's saying, "Where are they?" What he's really wanting to know is, are they still here? And they were. Now, who's he after, brothers and sisters? Who's Saul on the hunt for? He's after David. But you notice what he says. He comes and says, "Where's Samuel and David?" See what he's moved by? Where are Samuel and David? It's David he wants. But he couldn't help but mention Samuel first, because that's the man that was dominating his mind. The old prophet. And the power that that man exercised in that place that Saul knew that he could not dominate or challenge. Verse 23 says, "And he went thither to Naoth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God was upon him also, and he went on and prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramah." Of course, we can read verse 23 quickly, but you see what it's saying. What it's saying is this. Read verse 20. Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, then the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. So what we're told is this. The messengers came up, they came into Ramah, they came into the high place, they came into Naoth, they knocked on the door, they opened the door, they walked into the hall, and the Spirit of God came upon them. But verse 23 says that when Saul finally decided to come himself and to take David, he went thither to Naoth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God was upon him also well before he got anywhere near the city. He was already gripped by the influence of that power. Far stronger and far sooner than the messengers that he'd sent. Almost as if God had touched the heart of the king in order to reveal that power to him. And so, having finally come to Naoth in Ramah himself, having already been under the influence of the Spirit, verse 24 says, "And he stripped off his clothes, prophesied before Samuel in like manner, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Wherefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets?" When it says he stripped off his clothes, we don't believe that he took all his clothes off literally and lay down naked in that sense. We believe that the word clothes here literally is being used to indicate the outer garment and probably his royal robe. He took off his outer garment The royal robe of his office. If you come back to chapter 18 for a moment, it's rather interesting that in the first of Samuel chapter 18 and verse 3 we read, then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul, and Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his garments. And the word stripped in verse 4 is the same word being used here in chapter 19, verse 24, when Saul strips off his clothes. And we believe that the indication is that in symbol what Saul was saying was that he was prepared under the influence of this occasion to even hand, as it were, the kingship itself over to David. He took off the insignia of his royal office and said, give it to someone else. I'm prepared to relinquish the kingdom and the rulership to David himself, if necessary, just as Jonathan had indicated in chapter 18, verse 4. Such was the influence of the power of the Spirit that worked so mightily upon Samuel, on Saul, at this occasion. So he obviously had been moved in a very dramatic and powerful fashion. Now, coming back to the first of Samuel, chapter 19 and verse 24, not only does it say that he stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel, but it says he lay down. And in the margin, you'll notice that the word is translated that he fell down, and that is correct. And the margin refers us to Numbers 24, verse 4, which we won't turn up, but Numbers 24, verse 4 is the story of Balaam falling down into a trance. And the word literally means to fall flat on one's face. He fell flat to the earth under the influence of the Spirit that had come so mightily upon him. And isn't it interesting that in verse 24, really what happened was this. He comes, he divests himself of his royal robes, he falls flat to the ground, and he prophesies under the very feet of the man that he feared the most. And how symbolically significant it is that the final story we have here is of Saul prostrated at the feet of Samuel the prophet. Marvelous story. As if all the secrets of his heart had become known, and he confesses his unworthiness before the greatness of that old man who stood there as the champion and as the president of the prophets. Come and have a look at the first of Corinthians 14. Oh, look, you've got to look at this. This is good. The first of Corinthians chapter 14. Where did the Apostle Paul get this idea from? When he saw the whole ecclesia of the prophets prophesying, and Saul comes in, strips off his robes, falls flat on his face before Samuel. Now look at the Apostle's comment in the first of Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 24. Perhaps verse 23 for connection. If therefore the whole ecclesia be come together in one place, and all speak with tongues, and there come in those that are unlearned or unbelievers, will they not say that ye are mad? But if all prophesy, they saw all the company of the prophets prophesy, and there come in one that believeth not or is unlearned, Saul, he is convinced of all, he is judged of all, and thus are the secrets of his heart made manifest, and so falling down on his face, he will worship God and report that God is in you of a truth. Where did the apostle get that from? That's born out of the spirit of this dramatic moment in the life of Samuel and Saul as the king prostrates himself before Samuel in acknowledgement of the greatness of the prophet and the unworthiness of his own character. The secrets of his heart truly have been made manifest. And it appears that the apostolic comment is born, we believe, out of that moment in the confrontation of the first of Samuel, chapter 19. Well, we come back then to the end of that story. It says at the end of that verse, wherefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Because it really was quite unusual, wasn't it? It wasn't like that man at all. It was quite out of character for him to be so affected by spiritual things in that way. And I think that the lesson that therefore we take from the 24th verse is this. That you see, for us the ecclesia is Naoth, the place of learning and the house of study. It's what the ecclesia should be like. And the principles that Samuel was the champion of in Israel was hear God, the study of the word, heard of God, prayer unto him. And if those two principles are the presiding principles of ecclesial life, hear God, heard of God, then the ecclesia will be dominated by a similar spirit that swept through Naoth and invigorated all its inhabitants on that occasion. And the remarkable thing about that spirit in ecclesial life is this, that if we're prepared to give ourselves to those principles, as no doubt the College of the Prophets did, then the ecclesia will become the place of learning and the place of inspiration to all of us, and not only will it do that, but it is capable of transforming those who with quite opposite intentions are drawn within its orbit. That's what the ecclesia should be like, isn't it? That there is a spirit and power in the things of the truth there that can transform even those who with quite opposite intentions are drawn within its orbit. And it's true that there have been those that are antagonistic to the way of the truth, who've showed every bit the hostility of Saul, but when they've seen the spirit of the truth in our assemblies, they've been convinced. And in a symbolic sense, they have fallen down on their face and confessed that God is in us of a truth. Oh, brothers and sisters, that our ecclesias could be like that. But you've got to work at it. And we've got to give ourselves to those principles and to capture the spirit of dedication that prevailed in the days of Samuel, when with all the company of the prophets so wondrously prophesying, Samuel, in the greatness and oldness of his age, stood as appointed over them.